Welcome to this week's edition of the Third Opinion Podcast. Something special for you over the next 2 weeks, highlights of some of the best Third Opinion interviews of 2021. This week we hear from the Brandeis Center for Human Rights Under the Law about what they're telling college students about fighting anti-Semitism on campus, and an interview with the ADL about rising anti-Semitism in Florida. Remember to subscribe to Third Opinion wherever you get your podcasts. Here's this week's Third Opinion.
Good afternoon, or good evening, or good morning, whenever you're listening to us. This is Third Opinion on WKDW and the podcast. I am Mike Deason.
And I'm Lorene Jaffe.
Two Jews, three opinions. And what we're doing for the next 2 weeks in January, we want to show you some of our favorite interviews from the past year.
That's right. So for those of you who are new to us, just want to give you some little bits so you can find out what we're about. We are always trying to bring you interesting people so you can learn more about Israel and the Jewish world. Our first up is Kenneth Marcus, who we interviewed earlier in 2021, founder and chairman of the Louis D. Brandeis Center for Human Rights Under the Law. That organization, just so you know, helps college students, teachers, professors, et cetera, defend themselves against anti-Semitism and discriminations on campuses. So obviously, if you're a student or an educator being discriminated against, you definitely want to reach out to him. He did a study on anti-Semitism present day for Jewish observers on college campuses, and this is what he had to say.
Sometimes students who just happen to be Jewish don't really notice what is happening to those students who are either Jewishly observant or who are actively pro-Israel or are involved in the community. They might be asked questions like, do you think that it's safe to wear a kippah? And they'll think it is because they don't wear a kippah and they don't know anybody who wears a kippah. Or they'll be asked whether it's safe to go to pro-Israel events. And they'll think it is because they don't go to pro-Israel events and they don't know. So we wanted to know what is happening with those students who are openly, actively, proudly Jewish. What are they experiencing on the college campus? Because nobody had ever asked that question before.
Right, and I know your survey focused specifically on the APAI, the Jewish fraternity and sororities, where you would see many of these observant students. And so I'm sort of curious, share with the audience sort of what the current situation is that this survey concluded and what it observed when talking to these specifically observant students on college campus.
Sure. This was done the spring semester, so it's fresh. It's the most recent semester. It was an unusual semester. It was a COVID semester. It was a semester when many campuses were closed and where one would not expect to have the same number of in-person bias incidents because there were fewer students in person. It was also the year when so many universities around the country were so focused on addressing Black Lives Matter and the aftermath of George Floyd, and so there were more diversity, equity, and inclusion programs than we'd ever seen before. So we expected that this would be a year when things were relatively quiet in the sense of few bias incidents and in the sense that administrators would be sensitive to the issue. And so we were especially disappointed to find that roughly two-thirds of the students had issues with anti-Semitism in the prior semester. Students were feeling unsafe. Half of them had felt the need during the prior semester, at least at some point, to hide their Jewish identity for fear of anti-Semitism. And these were some of the most Jewishly active, involved, and proud students, and they felt the need to hide their identity. This is what we found especially disconcerting. And not only that, but the longer they were on campus, the more they felt they had to hide their identity. There were freshmen who had come on campus and think that things were relatively okay. But with each year on campus, up to their senior year, they became more and more concerned, more and more afraid about what was happening to Jewish students on campus.
So you said, you know, two-thirds. I mean, it's really amazing that you have two-thirds of these students that are seeing these open displays of anti-Semitism. What are some of the examples that these students were giving you, whether it's, you know, through the faculty, through other students, et cetera? What were some examples that they were telling you about that they were personally experiencing on campus?
Some of them were disgusting. I mean, I'm going to tell you, 2% of AEPI students had been spit at for being Jewish. Jewish students at both AEPI and AEPHI had been physically threatened. AEPI, several of them with weapons. A lot of what was happening was language. It was being cursed out. It was being told that Jews are greedy, Jews have too much power, things of that sort. But some of them were, it was actual physical, and it was bad.
You know, it's interesting because we recently on our local WEBU PBS channel, they had a conversation on anti-Semitism, and I participated in that panel with another college student, and he was talking about even fear of faculty. If his professors saw him wearing a kippah, that it would have a direct impact on his grade in that course. Did your students experience, you know, did they express anything along the faculty, or did the survey not go into that detail?
They absolutely did. Of the students who felt the need to hide their identity, and that was half of them, roughly one in third expressed a concern about the faculty, a concern that faculty would take it against them either in terms of their grades or otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, this is really concerning if you're a Jewish parent and you're getting ready to send your child off to school, that this is America and this is really happening even today. You know, one of the questions that obviously I have and many of the parents have and people in the Jewish community have is we feel like we have no recourse. I mean, what is it that we can do to fight this? How do we fight this?
These students and their families are not alone. There are organizations that are available to help them. 10 years ago, I founded the Lee Brandeis Center for Human Rights Under Law in Washington, D.C., in order to fight campus anti-Semitism using law and public policy. We represent a number of students, their families, and sometimes professors in holding universities accountable. Sometimes it's a matter of working with the administrators to urge them to voluntarily adopt policies and procedures that will support Jewish students. But sometimes it's a matter of actually holding them accountable through law, either in administrative agencies or in court.
I mean, and does the Brandeis Center regularly engage in that type of activity as far as litigation and lawsuits to the extent it's necessary to protect these students?
We have cases that are pending to protect both students and professors. It's something we've been doing for a number of years. At BrandeisCenter.com, people can reach out to us, and our lawyers will speak to students, professors, or families about the problems that they have. Yes, we've done this in a number of cases. And of course, I oversaw, as the Assistant Secretary of Education for Civil Rights, I developed and oversaw a process under which the federal agencies would make sure that colleges are responding to complaints of anti-Semitism.
Yeah, so I know, because I'm from Florida, so I know in the state of Florida, our governor had made the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition of anti-Semitism the law in the state and applies it to the universities, so the universities themselves can't engage in that discrimination. And I recall that President Trump also did something similar across public universities in this country, you know, with that definition of anti-Semitism to prevent that discrimination at the college level. I mean, what can we expect from the Biden administration? Are there any additional asks we have of his administration? So what are your thoughts as far as that's concerned?
Sure. I mean, the executive order on combating anti-Semitism was so important. That's something that the Brandeis Center had been urging for years. It was the primary recommendation of my book, The Definition of Anti-Semitism. And I think that getting that placed on the books was the biggest single advance in terms of fighting anti-Semitism through public policy that we've seen in many years. So I think it's very important. We would like to see the Biden administration enforce that executive order as forcefully as we did during the prior administration. So far, we've not heard that much from the Biden administration about it in the State Department. We've heard both from Secretary Blinken and also from a Deputy Assistant Secretary that they embrace, as an administration, they embrace the so-called IRA, working definition on anti-Semitism, that is the centerpiece of the executive order. That's very, very important. We've not yet heard from the Education Department or the Office for Civil Rights will use that domestically. And there was a time for several years when the federal government used the working definition only to criticize other governments and not for its own work. So it's very important that the Biden administration be consistent and use it both domestically and internationally. The executive order has not been rescinded. Like all of Trump's other executive orders, it has been archived from the White House website, but it's not been rescinded like the other Trump executive orders, and it remains incorporated into the active policy portal of the Education Department's Office for Civil Rights. That means that it is on the books as the law of the land. Now the question is, okay, it's on the books, but will the Biden administration forcefully embrace it? And that's what we still have to see.
So who under that administration? Obviously, is it specifically the Department of Education that we need to look to see that being implemented on the college campuses?
Yes, of course, it's the Education Department under Secretary Cardenas, but it would be under the leadership of my would-be successor, Catherine Lehman, who has been nominated to lead the Office for Civil Rights, although her nomination has been pending for quite a while, and the Senate committee split on party lines over whether to confirm her. So it's not yet clear who will be leading that office. For the time being, it's Acting Assistant Secretary Suzanne Goldberg. But I should mention, you mentioned Florida, and I would agree that the legislation signed by Governor DeSantis was very important. We've worked with some leaders in Florida to incorporate that in the universities, and we're very pleased that Florida State University became one of the first universities in the country to adopt the working definition of anti-Semitism. We would love to see other Florida colleges and universities do the same. Now that it's part of not just the federal law, but also the state law, we see no reason why they shouldn't. And certainly people who are involved with Florida colleges and universities should urge them to do the same.
And I'm curious about other states. You know, we follow very closely a lot of different states that have, you know, challenging issues for Jewish students. I mean, California really always seems to be at the top of the list. Do you have any hope or expectation that California will follow suit, and do something similar to what Florida did in adopting the IRA definition of anti-Semitism and beginning to enforce it on college campuses?
Regrettably, I think California will be one of the last states to do that. There were efforts to convince California to adopt the working definition a few years ago, and it met with a lot of political opposition. I advised the University of California Board of Regents several years ago, and while they would not adopt the working definition at that time, they did adopt an important statement in which they insisted their statement of principles against intolerance that anti-Semitism, including anti-Semitic forms of anti-Zionism, have no place at the University of California. That was an important statement because there had been so much resistance to the obvious truth that much of campus anti-Zionism is a hidden form of anti-Semitism. So we were glad to see the Regents accept that, and I think that statement has been influential around the country, but I unfortunately don't think that California is going to be ready for a while to follow Florida's lead.
So let's say you are a student in one of these states, California or elsewhere, that has a lot more problems. I mean, some of Florida's campuses, like USF and FSU, the students have had a lot of challenges there. But let's say you're in California. you know, what are some of their rights? What are the, you know, if the student's listening right now and they're experiencing harassment, what would you tell them? You have the following rights. I mean, so that they know, you know, what they can do to stop the harassment that's happening on campus.
Jewish students in California have the right to be treated the same as any other student. They have the right to equal treatment, and that right is protected under Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and we will help them to. We had one client, Rose Rich, at the University of Southern California, who was subjected to a really extraordinary, awful campaign to impeach her from her position as the vice president of the USC student government. We were able to help her to defeat the impeachment effort, but she ultimately decided to resign from office in the face of a really withering harassment campaign. We've represented other students in California fighting problems, either helping them to defeat efforts to exclude them or else to urge universities to take action to address the hostile environments that are forming many universities towards Jewish students.
And I was particularly pleased that they used the AEPi fraternity, of which I am a member, to help in this study. He's a fascinating guy. Next up is Benham Bentablu. Talk about him, Laureen.
Benham. So Benham Bentablu of the Foundation for Defense of Democracy is a think tank in Washington, D.C. One of our favorite regulars, Benham, is of Iranian descent, and that's really his focus. He concentrates and focuses on Iran and educating us here in America about some of the issues that are going on there as well as throughout the Middle East. And as we know, and as we regularly talk about, Iran is a major threat, not only to the existence of Israel, but really to the world and even here in the United States. So with that, here is Benham.
Here in the United States, in our country, Iran does have a long arm. And I think with the most recent attempt to kidnap an Iranian-American who is a U.S. citizen, who is a journalist and a human rights activist and actually works for a U.S. government broadcasting entity in New York, there was an attempt by Iran's Ministry of Intelligence by working actually through a front here who had actually been paying a U.S. private eye. This is all public information. Department of Justice put this out. Working through a U.S. public eye to track the movements of this human rights activist and advocate in Brooklyn, New York. And the goal was to get her out, kidnap her, take her via speedboat to a boat, take that boat to Venezuela, and potentially go from Venezuela to Iran. This is what Iran wanted to do on our territory. Make no mistake, the regime has a long arm and has shown from 1979, 1980 until present that they're not afraid to use that long arm. In 1979, 1980, they killed a former Iranian diplomat of the Shah era, here in Bethesda, Maryland. They actually used a disaffected convert to Islam, an American convert to Islam, to do it, and the guy fled the country after. Then, of course, you had the botched attempt to kill the Saudi ambassador in 2011 at an Italian restaurant in Georgetown, here also in Washington, D.C., working through drug cartels in Mexico, the Zetas, and through a contact of the Good Force who worked as a used car salesman, some kind of washed up guy also in Texas. Now, of course, you have this story, and that one contact that the Iranians had here, the woman who was the liaison between the American private eye and the Iranian Ministry of Intelligence, her cover was, as if you look online, as a makeup counterperson in a major department store in California. So the regime has used a long arm to try to carry out their terror and kidnapping and adjudicate their conflicts on our own soil. And I don't believe that'll end anytime soon. And they don't feel they've been deterred from it. If anything, those long periods of time between attacks tell us that the regime recalculates, recalibrates, takes constant measures of our resolve and our risk tolerance and our willingness to push back and our willingness to hold them accountable. And I'm very afraid that the message that we sent was too little, too late, and too weak. Because if the world's foremost state sponsor of terrorism is trying to kidnap an American citizen from American soil, there is much, much, much more that the Biden administration should have done. So that's point one about Iran in our backyard. Point two, of course, is Iran in the region, Iran itself, where Iran really isn't comfortable, not just with terror and proxies and cutouts, but really using hard power and throwing its weight around more formally and taking credit through weapons proliferation networks for the capabilities of its proxies and partners in the region. This is where you have to support friends, partners, and allies like the Israelis and some other actors in the region who are looking to improve their layered air and missile defense systems. You just had everyone, the international community, had a first-class seat to the success of something like Iron Dome in May of this year to offset the capabilities of Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad's rockets, many of which were proliferated by Iran, but also many of which Iran supported the local production of. You know, Iran has changing patterns of support to its proxies in the region. It's important Washington not just have a set-it-and-forget-it kind of approach, but keep an eye on the threat and make sure our partners and allies have everything they need, especially as we begin to pivot to focus on other larger issues, perhaps outside the Middle East. You can't just hope that one or two of your partners in the region will clean everything up. And I think this is the direction we're going in, where the Iranian assessment today, given the withdrawal in Iraq, given the ups and downs of the Obama era, which tried to course correct for the Bush era, and the Trump era, which tried to course correct for the Obama era, and the Biden era, which is trying to course correct for the Trump era, the impression that all these eras are giving to our friends and partners in the Middle East is one of lack of staying power and, unfortunately, something of a lack of credibility and resolve, at least on the Iran threat. And the Iranians are looking to amplify the concerns of U.S. partners in the region by doing more provocative things and showing how Washington will not respond in real time or will have a garbled response or something of that nature. So, yes, CENTCOM is doing a very powerful job. They have a deterrent role in the region. They're trying to constantly catch, expose, deter, disrupt a lot of Iran's illicit activities, be it on the maritime front. They just stood up a very, I think, what will be a very impactful drone program there in the region to counter Iran's unmanned aerial vehicles and unmanned aerial threats. That's going to be very important. But these things take time and require a lot of attention and require political support. And I don't know how much staying power the U.S. is really going to have as it tries to tackle things like China, as it feels content with leaving the region. And in fact, you can tie this all back into the Raisi speech, because Raisi said that America has not exited Afghanistan. America was expelled from Afghanistan. And the same day Raisi made that speech, you had the commander of Iran's missile program, Brigadier General Amir Ali Hajizadeh, go on TV saying that he made a pact, that Iran itself made a pact when Soleimani was killed, that Iran would evict America from the region. And I think that American policy recently under the Biden administration has been really to get out of Iran's way, and they're kind of in some way fulfilling this Iranian goal of having America be evicted from the region. And the next place to keep your eyes on, of course, will be Iraq.
Right. I mean, it is a lot to digest, you know, in this region and the aggression of Iran. Just quickly on that point, you know, is Iran in any way supporting the Taliban now and the Taliban government in Afghanistan?
Well, you know, I think it's important for the foreign policy community and the Iran watchers and Afghan watchers to constantly be updating their views on Iran and the Taliban. You know, I think gone are the days of the late 1990s where Iran almost went to war with Afghanistan because of the activities of the Taliban, which killed several Iranian diplomats in Mazar-e-Sharif. And, you know, Iran was de facto one of the main supporters of the Northern Alliance. And that relationship has changed because the Middle East is not the same as it was in the past two decades. The U.S. experience in Afghanistan and Iran's willingness to cut at Washington in every single theater, including in Afghanistan, by providing material support to any group, any terror group, including al-Qaeda, including the Taliban, means that Iran has actually developed somewhat warmer ties with the Taliban. So I think Iran is, you know, has at least three different sites open on its border where there are Afghan refugees that have poured in. The country has, you know, 2 to 3 million Afghan refugees already, really since 1979, 1980, due to the multiple conflicts on Iran's eastern front there. Iran has an all-Afghan division fighting in Syria, the Fatimiyun Brigade. They're Afghan Shiites that basically fight under the flag of Iran's pan-Shia army in the heartland of the Middle East. It'll be interesting to see what Iran does with those forces, if it repatriates them as a counter to the Taliban, or if it keeps them in the Arab world and begins to covet closer ties with the Taliban. It's a very fast-moving story, but the past two decades have shown that Iran will work with people who you may think may ideologically they may not be in 100% agreement with. You know, I think Washington overplays the importance of sectarianism here because ultimately Iran is a tactical actor, and they understand that if the Taliban are shooting at America or the Taliban are shooting at Iran's enemies, Iran is content to let them keep shooting in that direction. And if you have the world's foremost state sponsor of terrorism living next door to another major terror entity, then of course, you know, you can't get a good outcome from that.
Right. I mean, it's the same concept of Iran supporting, you know, Hamas, you know, the Shia and the Sunnis, you know, and sort of there's differences, and yet they're still supporting them and providing the funding, et cetera, for their terrorism, as well as Islamic Jihad. So, you know, two more quick questions, and, you know, because I don't want to lose sight of this. You and I had talked before we got on the interview about the 2015 law in Ara that Congress had passed, which, you know, deals with Iran and allowed former President Obama to enter the JCPOA, the deal with Iran without seeking congressional approval. And I sort of re-raise this again because many members of Congress, you know, whether it's Congressman Ted Deutch or it's Senator Menendez and so many others have, you know, expressed the need for stronger and better. I mean, and they are very, you know, laser focused on saying if we are going to do anything with this, you know, terrorist regime, then we need to have additional, you know, limitations, you know, including stopping the terror aggression, state sponsored terrorism, you know, stopping the human rights violations, addressing their missile defense program. And yet Congress may again not have a say in it. You want to comment on that?
I mean, I think it's critical for Congress to have a say or Congress to have a voice in any kind of future diplomacy with the Iranians, whether that diplomacy ends up being just a framework for a future deal, you know, something between the 2013 deal and the 2015 deal, or if it's just a clean resurrection of the 2015 deal, or if it's something much larger than that. But, you know, a critical component is why should the Iranian parliament, why should the Iranian Majlis know more about the ins and outs of negotiations rather than the U.S. Congress? You know, that's one. Two is we miss the entire experience of the Cold War if we think that Congress can't play a good cop, bad cop role and that there isn't a congressional role to play in arms control issues at the foreign policy level. And then I think lastly, it would mean that we haven't learned the lessons of the 2015 nuclear deal, which is to kind of, it's made everything so partisan. But when you look at, you know, past statements from Congress, people who, some who voted for the deal, some who voted against the deal, when you look at certain jurisdictions, when you look at the tallies of these former resolutions being passed because of Iran in advances to 5% or 20% enrichment, you know, these were sanctions resolutions being passed, you know, 98-1, 99-0, and Congress had a role to play then in keeping the Obama administration's feet to the fire in providing actual sticks to complement the Obama administration's carrots for coercive diplomacy with the Iranians. So Congress certainly has a role to play here. And whether it's going to come under the framework of the Inara law or not, I think remains to be seen. But by my standard, by my lay reading, it is totally applicable. The question is, what will the Biden administration do if they actually get some kind of deal? And I think whether that's a framework or a clean resurrection or something between the 2013 and 2015 deal, that remains to be seen. But if past this prologue, we don't have a good precedent for going around Congress. And I'm worried that with the Iran issue being more and more and more partisan, that things will not fall the way they should.
Okay. Thank you for that. I think it's important for people to understand that even though Congress has at least expressed, members have expressed the desire of having a say in it and wanting to make sure that it was stronger and better, there still is an opportunity for the president to go around Congress. Last, you know, I was hoping you would comment on the actual people in Iran. You know, the people have suffered, you know, tremendously under this regime. And we saw over the last 5 years, we saw it a lot under the Trump administration pre-COVID, many people taking to the streets in Iran, protesting the government, including factions of people who traditionally have been supportive of the Supreme Leader's government. You know, obviously COVID's had a tremendous impact in Iran, but what are we seeing today in Iran? Are we seeing these same movements? Are there still people who are interested in rising up against this government? I mean, obviously with President Raisi, the former butcher who, you know, killed many of them in the past who protested. I mean, has that movement been quieted? Or is there still an underground movement to rise up against the government?
You know, when Raisi yesterday talked about maximum tyranny, we hope that he wrote those lines while looking in the mirror or while looking at his friends and colleagues and comrades, because that is what has become of Iran in the past four decades, maximum tyranny. You could not have a better example as to what the Islamic Republic of Iran has become on the world stage by sending that butcher and his video to be played at the international community stage at the UN General Assembly just the other day. So ultimately, that is the face of the regime. Ultimately, that is the nature of the regime. The good news is that that is not the people. That is not the average Iranian. That is not the views, values, ideals, interests expressed by Iranians. You basically have an Islamist regime ruling over a nationalist population. You have a revolutionary regime ruling over a post-revolutionary population. And this is a combination that, by virtue of time alone, as well as the past century of Iranian history, which has been looking for representative government and actually justice as well, that is a toxic combination that cannot hold, and that is the good news here. The problem is, of course, COVID certainly provided battering. The regime's security forces remain cohesive, and as many protests as there were, particularly 2017 to 2020, which really required the foreign policy community to torpedo all the myths it had about America, not, you know, America should not say anything, or America should not, you know, support protesters when they go out into the streets, or American support would be the kiss of death, or anything like that. You know, you had Iranians protesting saying, our enemy is here. They lie when they say it's America. Or you had Iranians protesting against, you know, their left and right flanks inside their own country, basically saying, reformist, principalist, the jig is up. You had Iranians critiquing the foreign and security policy of the Islamic Republic, saying, not Gaza, not Lebanon, my life for Iran, saying, forget Syria, think about us. You couldn't have a more clearer picture of what opposition to the Islamist regime in Iran looks like. It is these people. It is these average Iranians. And it even is these people who the second generation of which the regime had wanted to put its trust into to kind of propel the regime into the next generation. But ultimately, these are folks who, because of the regime's mismanagement and the mere fact of challenging life in Iran, are not regime supporters.
He always has fascinating things to say. Another fascinating, I thought, interview this year was after the conflict with Hamas and Israel and the anti-Semitism that rose up. And here in Florida, where we are based, it really got bad. And we talked to Lonnie Welk of the ADL in South Florida about the rising tide of anti-Semitism.
Well, what we are seeing is definitely concerning. Across the country and right here in Florida, we've seen over the last 6 or 7 years, we've seen a steady spike, a steady increase in anti-Semitic incidents. ADL tracks anti-Semitic incidents that are reported to us, that we're made aware of through the media, that we are made aware of or connect with law enforcement about. So it's, even though our audit of these anti-Semitic incidents is not per se an exact accounting style audit, in the sense that we don't have all of the incoming data regarding every incident that occurs anywhere, it does give us a unique lens in looking at trends and issues, looking at where incidents are happening, where what motifs, the type of offender, if we know those. And what we have seen over the years is really just the steady increase in anti-Semitic incidents in our country. We've seen a rise in incidents coming from the left, coming from the right, incidents, anti-Semitic incidents that incorporate Holocaust and Nazi type imagery or rhetoric. Nationally, interestingly though, nationally in 2020, we had a 4% decrease in anti-Semitic incidents in the incidents that ADL tracks. We had a 4% decrease, which was still at overall at record levels. However, in the state of Florida, we tracked a 40% increase in anti-Semitic incidents, 40. Mm. So that is definite cause for concern. And we, again, we're seeing incidents from vandalism of institutions. We're seeing individuals being harassed. We are seeing students reporting anti-Semitic incidents. So it's definitely of increasing concern throughout the country and right here at home.
Well, we've certainly had our incidences here in the Tampa Bay area. The Florida Holocaust Museum had graffiti on it. There was a parking lot in a condo. It's everywhere you turn. Why do you think in Florida there's a 40% increase? What's the trigger?
Well, we had a variety of issues. Again, one of the interesting or problematic, not interesting components that we've definitely seen is issues coming from multiple sectors seemingly simultaneously. So we had anti-Semitic Zoom bombing incidents, which who the heck heard of the term Zoom bombing before the pandemic set?
Right.
But it was interesting that we had this when the pandemic began. There were many that said, you know what, we will probably see fewer incidents overall of anti-Semitic and otherwise, because there's less of, there was the expectation that there was going to be less, much less human interaction. People were staying at home. People were on lockdown. So without that human interaction, and then shortly thereafter, we started getting reports of this thing called Zoom bombing. And one of the first reported incidents that we had here in Florida was horrible. It was a family that was burying a loved one, and while they were graveside, someone and the funeral was being put up on Zoom, and while they were graveside, someone hacked in and shared Nazi and anti-Semitic horrible messaging that appeared on the screen. So while this family was literally burying their loved one, they were faced with vile anti-Semitism. Mm. So even when you can think that the methodology for spreading hate or anti-Semitism is lessened, those who want to spread hate will find a way to make it happen. We did monitor and track incidents throughout the state from, as you mentioned, incidents in right there in Tampa. We had other institutions throughout the state vandalized. And then going into this year, in addition to the types of incidents we saw last year, going into May of this year, during the conflict between Israel and Hamas, we had anti-Israel incidents which bled into anti-Semitism. And those are also significant concerns throughout our area, on college campuses throughout the country. So we're seeing a lot of a great deal of anti-Semitism spring up from many different areas, all seemingly simultaneously.
You know, it seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, that there is a difference between the anti-Semitism on the right and the left. On the right, it seems to me, they just hate Jews completely. They hate Muslims as well. I mean, they're put in that same category and all, and they want to be like almost an Aryan nation. Where on the left, it seems to be more pro-Palestinian and lies about apartheid and then the BDS movement. They seem separate to me. They're both anti-Semitic. They're both hurtful. They're both hateful. But I think there is a separation. Am I wrong on that?
There are definitely differences in gradation. Some of the anti-Semitism that we see, and we're using the terms right and left, you know, kind of as a catch-all for things that are obviously very nuanced. But we're seeing, over the years, we've seen a significant drive-up in extremism related that incorporate anti-Semitism. And over the course of the last few years, I mean, we just had the anniversary 2 days ago of the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, where white supremacists gathered, the largest white supremacist gathering in decades, and the chant was pretty clear: Jews will not replace us.
Yeah, clear as day, right? Yes, there were some people
they were saying,
well, they didn't say that, and they did.
And what was interesting there was they weren't saying Jews will not replace us. In other words, they would not be themselves be replaced with Jewish people. That wasn't what they were saying. They were working off of a conspiracy theory that Jews were going to be bringing in immigrants who would therefore replace, in their minds, white people. And so that dynamic was what they were, and that conspiracy is what they were referring to. So we've got, and we've got the extremism from those groups and from those types of ideologies, white supremacist ideology, which has by and large led and has been seen in a great deal of extremist-related violence. So there's a massive amount of concern there. There is much more of a, you know, ADL. CEO Jonathan Greenblatt just wrote a piece in the Washington Post talking about the subtlety of anti-Semitism coming from progressive circles, but that the anti-Semitism, whether it's coming from the right, the left, or anywhere in between, really needs to be taken extremely seriously and challenged at every turn. And you know, we were speaking earlier, you know, one of the things that I think is incumbent on people to do, we get asked frequently, well, you know, these are very large issues and not every person can take action when there is anti-Semitism at this 30,000 foot level, or if there's extremism, or if it's something on the news. But what everyone can do, we all belong, or we all affiliate with political groups, with interest groups, with ethnic groups. When we see anti-Semitism or any kind of bigotry, but especially from a group with which we identify, we must call it out. We must question it. It's not enough if you are a conservative to call out anti-Semitism when it comes from progressive circles. It is not enough if you're a progressive to call out anti-Semitism from conservative circles. It must be called out you have the strongest voice when you're a progressive and you call out progressive anti-Semitism. When you're a conservative and you call out conservative-related anti-Semitism. And when there is bigotry we're speaking about anti-Semitism, but when there is non-anti-Semitic bigotry, Islamophobia, homophobia, xenophobia, any kind of bigotry, we as the Jewish community must speak up and must speak up loud. As much as we look into and need allies, especially now, we also need to be allies, especially now.
I couldn't agree more. You spawned a couple of questions. First off, with the Charlottesville trial just getting underway and the insurrection trials ongoing, and certainly a lot of the Proud Boys, as one of the groups, wore anti-Semitic shirts and jerseys and all that, is there a concern that this will ignite some of their followers to become even more anti-Semitic or maybe more overt than they had been before?
I'm not 100% certain if the chief concern, the primary concern, is particular to any individual extremist or extremist group, though we are monitoring them strongly. I think the larger issue is the cultural and societal impact that those groups and seem to be having more and more, and leaders, cultural leaders that we have, political leaders, elected officials, education leaders. When we have a society that does not stop bigotry or hate in its lower track, in its lower forms, heck, even in things like simple jokes or inappropriate language, when we as individuals, if you hear a friend make a joke, make a slur, and you don't challenge it, things like that have a way of becoming societally ingrained. And so when you have the acceptance of belittling language, of anti-Semitic language, of homophobic language, and so on, deeper systemic acceptance of that bigotry takes hold and escalates and escalates until you have anti-Semitic or bias-motivated violence. And so when we look at extremists, very few people in this world are born extremists. We have a unique opportunity to move the needle societally when we call out anti-Semitism, when we call out bigotry, when we have any leader from the President of the United States to the President of the PTA, from the local dog catcher to a sports celebrity, when we see or hear anti-Semitism, we don't necessarily need to confront every bit of anti-Semitic rhetoric in the same fashion. We can have a conversation. It doesn't mean calling out anti-Semitism doesn't mean denouncing the person who made that comment. In other words, there's a very important and nuanced difference. When you hear something, an anti-Semitic remark, an anti-Semitic comment, there's a difference between saying to someone, what you said came across to me as anti-Semitic, and here's why. Let me give you a little bit of an understanding of why that came across to me as anti-Semitic. There's a difference between that and you're anti-Semitic.
Lonnie always has good things to say.
Yes, he
really does. The other one that we want to talk about is Daniel Scheck, who is talking about, he's a former ambassador, the rise of anti-Semitism in Eastern Europe. It's really disturbing, and he's got his finger on the pulse. Here's Daniel Scheck.
Since nationalism is the name of the political game in Poland for the last decade and more, where there is nationalism, anti-Semitism and bigotry are never far. So one shouldn't really be very surprised that on the national holiday, specifically, you have these really scary images, I must say. They're pretty horrific.
Yeah, burning the texts. And,
yes, burning Jewish texts.
A lot of tangible anger there,
Tangible anger, but in a country that has anti-Semitism embedded for many, many centuries. It was also a place where millions of Jews used to live. So, I mean, there's always this duality. It was a place where Jews were welcome, but they were also denigrated and hated. So that is on the emotional side. Now, politically, this certainly doesn't serve the Polish government, and I'm not surprised that they rushed to condemn with all the sometimes subtleties that you can find in tolerating certain aspects of anti-Semitism and anti-Jewish sentiment in Poland. Such images really don't serve them, and so I'm happy to observe that at least the official part of Poland, including the Catholic Church, by the way, have strongly condemned these demonstrations.
Well, along those lines, is there a diplomatic opening for Israel to be getting involved in this, or is this really more of a domestic Polish issue?
It's both, you know. It's a domestic issue, obviously. It's Jewish, Polish Jews are Polish citizens, and they are under the protection, should be under the protection of Polish law and Polish law enforcement. But Israel can't completely look away. I mean, if this is the homeland of the Jewish people and it's the Jewish state, then there is always a Jewish dimension, a global Jewish dimension to Israeli policy. And we've seen this over the years with the Polish laws that limit the possibility to claim property confiscated by the Nazis. Israel was present, and Israel should continue to be present, but we have to tread carefully because it's a very sensitive relationship in the past few years. And I must add that Foreign Minister Yair Lapid has a personal emotional issue here.
Yeah, we've seen that on display.
We've seen this on display. It hasn't always served his good judgment, I must say, but it's understandable. I completely understand him, even if, you know, some experts on Jewish history and Polish history could argue with some of the claims that he makes. I think that he very well expresses this particular position of Israel as a state when it's faced with such displays of anti-Semitism anywhere around the world.
Does this widen the rift? You mentioned touch on some of the issues that have caused a rift truly between Israel and Poland in just very recent years. Is this something that may widen that or maybe not based on the response of the government?
I hope not, because there's really no interest to continue widening this rift. Poland is an important country within the EU and an important country for bilateral relations with Israel. So the diplomat in me would always hope that there is a solution somewhere and that we can reestablish relations of confidence between the two countries. But yes, as you were saying, since the official Polish position is very firm on this incident for once, I think we should encourage that and not make the problem worse.
It's disturbing, but it's important we talk about it all the time. But that's all the time we have. We're going to do it again next week with more of our favorite interviews. This is The Third Opinion. I'm Mike Deason.
I'm Lorraine Jaffe.
Bye.
That's our podcast this week. Don't forget to subscribe to Third Opinion wherever you get your podcasts. Until next week, thanks for listening.